Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nicholas Investment Insights. This week, our attention turns to the future of the current global mining boom. After a strong year in 2020 for most major commodities, including nickel, tin, copper, and gold, the resumption of normalcy post the global pandemic presents further tailwinds for commodity producers in 2021, particularly in Australia. Potentially confounding the continuing boom, however, are trade tensions that have ramped up between China and other major economies, including the raft of restrictions on Australian commodities late last year, sparking a new global effort to lessen the reliance on China for both the import and export of mainstream and specialty commodities, which may have an impact on traditional pricing models and forecasts. And finally, Joe Biden's administration has indicated that it backs Australia's growing integration into US supply chains of for rare earths and other critical minerals, such as lithium and copper, at the heart of the growing electric vehicle, renewable energy and battery revolution. So what lies in store for global commodities and their producers in 2021 and beyond? Joining us to share his views and research on global mining is David Radcliffe. David has over 15 years' experience as a mining analyst and 5 years in the industry with North, Homestake and Newcrest. Technically qualified as a geologist and geophysicist, he is currently Managing Director of specialty research firm Global Mining Research, which offers independent global coverage of metal and mining companies without conflict of interest. David Radcliffe, welcome to Nucleus Investment Insights.
Great. Thank you for having me on.
Good to have you on as well, and here to share his views on the future of global mining and how these themes can impact our portfolios. I'm joined by Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hello to you, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
Good to have you on. And also on the line, joining with great interest, we're also joined by our Chief Strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith. Hello, David.
G'day.
Good to hear. Just a quick reminder before we get started, if you haven't already, please subscribe and click the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. We also ask if you could take a moment to click like on the video now to help our show grow. And of course, any questions, feel free to drop them into the box in the YouTube chat and we'll have them answered along the way as well. So let's get into it. The agenda for today. We're going to kick off with iron ore, having a bit of a look at the exposures, China exposure in particular of iron ore. We'll then move across to lithium, battery hype versus mine economics, sounds very interesting. Across to gold, of course, relationships between gold miners and gold price. Staying tuned for that one, actually, quite an interesting conversation ahead. And then finally, copper, the effect of electric vehicles and solar on copper. And as always, we'll round that out with an investment outlook and how we use these themes and implement them every day here in the portfolios at Nucleus Wealth. So with no further ado, we'll jump across to our first topic of the day, iron ore China exposure. Who'd like to take it away? Damien?
Yeah, so I guess, David, I just want to put in perspective, you know, what we're really interested in sort of some of the macro views and where... I guess the industry economics line up versus what we're seeing in some of the macro views. So one of them in particular, so we'll get on to a few of the other metals and happy as well for you to jump in with you know, alternative metals where you know, you've got particularly strong or negative views on. Mm. But I sort of wanted to try and go through the sort of the three or four big sort of hyped ones at the moment. And starting, I guess, with iron ore, where I guess we look upon it, just to give you a background to how we're looking and be interested to see how you contrast with it, is we look upon it as very much a China exposure, and that we're looking at the global, so we're looking at it being, while China keeps pumping up more and more debt and keeps building, and we've got a sort of a chart up on the slide deck there, Tim can show just the Chinese floor space under construction sort of being at record levels. While that keeps occurring, there's this demand for iron ore, but the flip side is if that starts to tail off, like we saw in sort of 2015, you know, even just flat, without sort of just flat floor space under construction, seemed to have a pretty big negative effect on the iron ore price, and also the increase in steel as well. Sorry, increase in recycling, so that over the medium term, we're expecting that... you know, that will come back, but it's just a question, I guess, over the next 6 to 12 months, what's happening and how much of it's sort of China dependent and how much of it is dependent upon other factors, I guess, supply sides?
Yeah, okay. So let's start with the easy question then. So I guess when you think about iron ore, and the way we sort of think about it is, you know, typically over the last couple of years, the questions have been really not around how high the price can go, but rather the other way around. So what I guess has been a concern and what people have focused on is, you know, when does Chinese demand plateau? And as you mentioned, that scrap supply, how quickly does that come into the market? How quickly is it adopted? And therefore, how much demand does that displace for iron ore from the seaborne market? And so really the question has been more recently, you know, what is that long run price? And the assumption being it's probably a lot lower than what we see today. However, I guess over the last couple of years, we haven't dived off that cliff in terms of the iron ore prices. And I think there's a few key reasons why that are probably worth exploring. We start with the supply side. It's pretty significant to acknowledge that, you know, in early 2019, there was a massive supply shock to the iron ore seaborne market. And that really took what generated that was obviously the Brumenio tailings dam collapse from Vale, and Vale being one of the largest top three producers in the world. You know, that collapse meant that their Brazilian asset base had production shrink in 2019 by 20%. But then last year, we saw that level maintained, so down 20%. So what we've actually seen is out of one of the major producers in the world, production has been down significantly on what we thought. It hasn't recovered, although it's just starting to recover now. And on top of that, Vale was expecting to be now north of 400 million tons of supply into the market. So we've had a pretty big supply shock that I think sometimes people just sort of look over. And at the same time, we've seen quite a bit of discipline out of the Australian producers. So one of the key drivers of the price we've seen has been the fact that supply has underwhelmed. Then on the demand side, again, everyone kind of thought that China would struggle to get a billion tons of Chinese steel production. And certainly not being able to then grow that production. And I guess what we're seeing this year is that China exceeded a billion tons of steel production in 2020, and that was growth of 5%. So we've now got the largest producer in the world still growing at 5%, and that's really, I think, one of the key things that's underpinned where we see the price today. But I think, you know, going forward, we've started to see in the last couple of days a bit of a roll in Chinese steel prices. We've seen the Chinese government call for reduced output from the steel mills in 2021, in part to ingest, you know, to address the environmental concerns they have. But, you know, as we've seen before, you know, how effective can the call for lower production actually be? So I think, you know, near term, why we are where we are is because we've had a supply shock and we've had, you know, the largest supplier grow or consumer growing at quite a big rate. And any growth of such a big base obviously has a big impact on the iron ore price.
And obviously the some of the COVID stuff as well sort of slowed them down sort of earlier on last year. But are you expecting, or how much of a bounce back are you expecting in Vale production over the next year?
Well, this is one of the interesting things. We don't actually expect Vale to get back to the levels they were before the actual tailings dam collapse until 2022 and then continue to grow. So this is why, you know, I think in the near term we can continue to see an iron ore price, you know, in the order of $100 plus for probably the next year or two. But then we start to see, obviously, the supply coming through. And then the other thing to talk about is actually what's happening with scrap. And I guess when we talk about the Western world and we talk about their steel production, scrap generally represents about half of the materials that go into producing that steel. Now, for China, they're currently around a quarter, so obviously well below the Western level. And that's part of the argument that in time they should be moving towards that level of about half. Now, the current policy is that China hopes to get to about 30% scrap use in steel by 2025. So it's going to take a while to actually get up to those kind of Western levels.
Yes, and so and what are you using as your long term pricing for iron ore?
Yeah, so basically from our point of view, and we're talking about the 62% landed price here because there's many types of iron ore. But we think this year it'll probably be about $145. Now, that's an average over the year, obviously well above that now, but you know, it's an average for a year, so there'll be times when it's higher, times when it's lower. But we think that eventually it'll come down to a level over the next sort of 3 to 4 years, probably closer to $70 a ton.
Yep. And at that level, and is that sort of mainly supplied by sort of just the majors at that point? I guess, you know, sort of 10 years ago, we saw a lot of the really small mining ones sort of start up. And you know, even just trucking the iron ore in and out, given prices were so high, but I guess as prices fell, most of those exited the market. Is that I guess are you seeing any of those sort of starting up with current prices, or you're happy that just the production from the majors will be enough to bring the prices back?
Yeah, look, I mean, so today's prices are incentive for just about everyone to go out and start putting a bit of iron in a bucket and exporting it. But look, at the end of the day, Brazil will recover and Brazil will increase levels towards where we thought they were going to, so north of 400 million tonnes. We've still got some capacity within Australia to meet that long-term demand and to incrementally grow volumes from where they are now. And with increased scrap, as I mentioned before, means that a long-term price is very unlikely to be where we see it today. So, given the very large resource bases of the majors, I think that they will be still the key guys to supply any incremental tons into the market over the midterm.
Okay, so and supply side, sorry, demand side, I guess are you how closely do you sort of track the demand side? I guess what are you seeing on that front?
Well, I mean, demand at the moment is obviously very, very strong. China's importing at the moment over 100 million tons. Well, the last 6 months, the average has been 100 million tons per month of imports. I think, you know, one of the things to obviously look at is what's happening in the construction side over there. And, you know, the construction side has been growing at 5% a year. Obviously, it will be lower this year, but actually it's probably still likely to see a couple of percent of growth. But I think, you know, there's been quite a few commitments to new infrastructure projects over recent months, and that probably means that, you know, over the midterm, we continue to see the Chinese construction sector and obviously key infrastructure projects that have high steel intensity at a similar sort of rate over the midterm.
And so when you say the infrastructure projects with high steel intensity, which ones do you sort of target in particular? So again, I guess just to give some background, I guess my understanding is that, you know, buildings in particular use up a huge amount of steel, and a lot of the say rail, for example, doesn't use anywhere near as much steel as what you might think relative to sticking up a bunch more buildings.
Yeah, and there's obviously different classes, but yeah, look, traditionally, rail is one of the things that you would look at. Bridges, you know, all the sort of those sort of projects are the ones you'd be thinking about. But I think, you know, overall, you know, again, this is the thing that I think is one of the key things when you look at China. It doesn't have to be a high growth rate given the size of their construction industry to have any, you know, a reasonably meaningful impact on underlying demand.
Yep. So, David Lawland Smith, do you have questions you wanted to ask?
No. I guess the main one, Dave, hi, is why? Do you have any more detail on why you think Vale will be slow to normalize its production, and other than the fact that it's failed just about every one of its own benchmarks.
Yeah, look, we're actually talking about pretty significant volumes, and these are volumes that have to be mined, have to be put on rail and put onto a boat and then exported. And we're talking about, tens of millions of tons. So I think it takes a while to ramp up, but some of their key projects like S11D, which was one of the new ones that was expected to have already delivered that net number somewhere north of 400 million tons, has been built. But it's a very tricky situation they're dealing with there in terms of managing the regulatory environment, given such a large environmental disaster that they had with the loss of the tailings dam, increased regulation that they see of all their existing dams, and et cetera. So I think the key message is they're going to come back. It's going to take a little bit of time, but all the key infrastructure is in place, or nearly in place, to deliver those high volumes.
But to be clear, you see them missing their own resumption targets a little, do you?
No, look, I don't think the targets that have been set are aggressive.
Okay.
But this is a business that has had a history over the last decade or so of pushing back targets. So I guess our view is probably a little bit conservative, but history would show that's not a bad way to be.
Yeah, good.
And I guess just for anyone listening in, the part of the reason we're quite interested in iron ore, not so much just for the companies themselves, but also the effect on the Aussie dollar in terms of seeing that the Australian, as iron ore prices sort of move, the Australian dollar moves sort of very much in concert with them, and so. And more so than I guess we see other minerals, and so sort of moving on to some of these other minerals, I guess there's always this effect is that if you see the Aussie dollar start to fall, that obviously has effects on some of the other ones that isn't quite as direct, like you don't quite get the same offset. So we had I'll probably put it back to you first, Dave. So we've got some of the other ones we wanted to talk about. We wanted to talk lithium, gold and copper. Is there any other metals in particular that you find interesting at the moment, either on a positive side or a negative side?
Look, I think they're the key ones, obviously, at the moment. Iron ore, because it is such a cash cow for the diversifieds and anyone producing it at the moment. The margins are exceptionally high because we're at a record price. Lithium, obviously, is very, dare I say, trendy at the moment because of the whole EV argument, which is really justified, and I think we'll get onto it in a minute. We're still those very early days, I think, within that picture. But I mean, the way to think about it is we're starting 2021 with effectively the three key commodities and very important ones for Australia being iron ore, gold and copper, all at record levels. And obviously part of that relates to a very large part of that relates to expectations that 2021 will be a lot better than what 2020 was. I think there's still a lot of uncertainty around that, but one of the key things that's obviously driving current commodity prices is the expectation of a lower US dollar, where the ongoing stimulus will continue to put pressure on the US dollar. And to your point, a lot of these commodities are very tied, obviously, to the US dollar.
Mm. And in broad terms, there's seen some quant stuff out there that's basically on a longer term basis looks at the resources sector and basically says, if you want to make money from this sector, you wait until you haven't seen any capex for years, and then you go and buy it. And when you're seeing lots of capex, that's time to sell it over if you're taking a sort of 3 to 4 year view on this. So I don't know. Obviously, there's individual factors that'll make a difference to that in the short term, but from a capex perspective, it doesn't seem as if there's lots of capex out there in any of these sectors. And I'd probably almost say that COVID's put a dent into some of the capex, rather than which might sort of lead to the if you do get a snap back that you might get some more shortages in these space.
Yeah, so I mean that's a really good question. So effectively, if we think about it, I mean the record capex was obviously It was a decade ago now, and we had companies overspent, overinvested. We had too much supply coming into the market, and that obviously was one of the drivers that held prices down. Then we went through the phase of companies realizing that they'd made bad decisions, promising to the market that they'd never do it again, cutting costs, cutting capex discipline, repairing balance sheets. And that's certainly why I think this time around it's a little bit different from what we saw in the GFC, because balance sheets have never been stronger. Promising to reward shareholders and to a large degree delivering to that. So we've sort of gone through that trough and now we're at the stage where, you know, portfolios are lacking in a lot of, you know, new assets to commit to. There are some, but you're right, overall capital is lower, much lower than what it was at the previous peak. But what we are starting to see is companies starting to reinvest where they can. And obviously, another point being, obviously, the regulatory market's got a lot harder than what it was. So we're sort of in that upward trend now for capital, where companies are generating surpluses, the balance sheets are extremely lazy, so they are putting capital to work. You could argue that this is the time where we start to see some spending that maybe isn't sort of justified, or certainly not the investment processes are not, or there's some cheating on those processes that the last few years ago were almost ironclad. But we are in an upward tick, and we've even just seen that in the last couple of months with some of the pre-releases for this year. And you know, there's probably, if I take the international golds as an example, you know, capital 20% higher than what it was last year, as they start to, you know, while they are making money, they're happy to reinvest in, and some of those more nice to have projects than the ones that had strict capital hurdles over the last couple of years.
Okay, so lithium, we skipped to that. So I guess the reason why I wanted to sort of jump on lithium is because we haven't got any at the moment in our portfolio, and not to say there's actually that many big ones we can invest in, but I guess I've sort of taken the view that, look, it seems as if there's just lots and lots and lots of lithium out there that's available in this sort of $5,000 to $10,000 range that would be profitable, and projects are could pretty much supply whatever the world wanted at that level, and so it's really just an issue of sort of short-term demand spikes versus when the longer-term supply comes on, or am I oversimplifying it?
No, I don't think so. Look, it's been one hell of an interesting space, even in the last couple of months. I mean, you're right, there's only a few ways to play it in the Aussie market, but after having absolutely terrible 12 months, all those junior lithium names have put on 100% in the last quarter. So the market's clearly thinking or assuming that the worst behind it. And again, it is quite a trendy thing. So if we think about the lithium market, I mean, the current spot price, despite starting to recover, to us is still well below the incentivization levels for additional production. And we're still seeing producers holding off on new mines or expansion projects. One of the key things I think to recognise here is there's a lot of idle capacity. And if I take Australia as an example, we've got mines such as Wodgina, Bald Hill and Altura that are effectively waiting to restart. And I think why they're important is from the fact that, we think that, current consumption of lithium is over 300,000 tonnes of LCE, which is lithium carbonate equivalent. On our numbers, we have the market growing to somewhere in the order of north of 700,000 tonnes of global demand by 2025. But those mines that are currently idle could represent around a third of that demand. So, over the next sort of 5 years, you've got to see those restart, and then I think you can start to see some of the hopefully price that then incentivizes new projects to meet that demand. But as you said, lithium is not scarce. lithium is something that's relatively abundant. It's also still a relatively small market, and it's an emerging market. So, you know, one or two new mines can have a very big impact on the market and supply.
Yeah, and actually that was where I was going to lead with that question as well, is that it also seems to me that the, you know, let's say you pick the gold market, for example, there's scope from the gold market for smaller mines to come in and out. It's not like gold's not really something that you do, you mine in bulk. Whereas I guess whereas the iron ore is obviously, is dominated by the big players because they just, you get all these massive economies of scale when you just produce lots and lots and lots of this stuff. And it seems to me that the lithium market is very much the same in that you want bulk mining techniques. You want to just get your economies of scale and just really drive the cost down as far as you can to make these things successful. And so somebody new starts a massive mine in whatever, Bolivia or somewhere in South America, that could just ruin the entire world's economics.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, as an example, Wodgenaar, which is one of the Australian mines that's currently on care and maintenance, can produce 100,000 tonnes of LCE. And as I said, consumption, if I take 19 as an example for the world, is 300,000 tonnes. So you've got some very large projects there that at the moment rival, because the market's just not evolved enough. Now, we think it will evolve in time, but we're still at a very early stage of this lithium journey. But it's interesting because we've had some big acquisitions. Independence Group just paid $1.4 billion US for 25% of Greenbushes. And actually, I think we'll probably see a bit more consolidation over the next year in the lithium space as prices start to recover. Companies repair balance sheets, etc. The other thing is, and to maybe give a bit of an example there, is EVs obviously and the key consumer of lithium, and we expect that to continue, and it's to be around 7% of lithium consumption by 2025. But in terms of the global vehicle market, in 2019, it was about 2.3 million vehicles which were EV, which is a penetration rate of only about 2.5%. Now, that looks like it's increased, and it's currently around 4%, but it's still quite low.
Yes. Yeah, and so the message is that lithium seems to me is, you can trade it, and if there's, but in the times when you're sort of making 100, 200% returns and prices shooting up and there's big projects coming back on, you want to be looking very carefully as to when you take your profits as opposed to just a set and forget. Throw it in and everything will be good.
I think so, and it just comes back to look at the history of the rare earths market, uranium market, all these small markets where one mine can have a fairly big difference just means they're a lot more volatile. And so I think you're right, it's something you have to focus a little bit more on trading rather than a set and forget.
And while we're talking trading gold, I suppose there's one of the questions I guess we put to you beforehand is just sort of the relationships between the gold miners and the gold price, and I guess your thoughts around what we're seeing in the gold market.
Yeah, sure. So look, gold is really highly correlated, obviously, the gold company is very highly correlated to the gold price, and I think specifically the US dollar gold price, and that's been one of the key things recently. This really reflects, I think it's what people sometimes forget is that gold really is, unlike say lithium or iron ore we were talking about before, it is a very scarce element. And the thing that we sort of always say is that when we're measuring gold's abundance, we're measuring it in parts per million, contrast to say a base metal where you're measuring it in say 1 to 10% of content or bulk commodities, which are obviously much, much higher. I think, to us, the thing about gold at the moment is that, it is in an interesting space. It is a very strong price. We do think that the US dollar has some, obviously some downside risk. You know, the gold market put on nearly $400 an ounce last year. I mean, that would obviously be great to see this year, but I think, you know, it's going to be a volatile market, as the last couple of weeks have shown. The price does have several drivers pulling on it, which is always the way for gold. And the trick is obviously picking which one of those drivers is going to win short-term and influence the price. But
And it's a circular reference nature as well, isn't it? I've got a chart up, we're showing just a chart of that, the gold, the demand for gold. And you can see 2019, in terms of actual physical demand for jewelry and technology, sort of, I guess, industrial demand, sorry. You know, that was down, I don't know, maybe 30-something percent over the year, as it fell from, you know, just under 2,000 tonnes to just over 1,000 tonnes. And it was really the lift in the ETFs and central banks and investors trying to chase it. So it's almost that, well, it's not almost, it is that part is, isn't it, where part of what you're trying to do is just, if other investors are interested, then there'll be more demand, which will mean prices will go higher. And so it's a bit of the greater fool in terms of the, whereas you don't get investors in the iron ore market, or the lithium market holding, you know, more than half of what the production is.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the other point is you know, we were talking about upside to production that was out of iron ore and out of lithium, but you know, we recently did a study on the top 25 gold companies in the world and what they're investing in and what that means for the outlook for gold. And that's obviously the majority of the mine supply. Obviously, recycling is very big as well within gold, but from mine supply point of view, you know, we do see those large companies without an accelerated investment seeing their supply into the market start to roll off in the next 3 to 5 years, and you know, that obviously has an impact as well. But you're right, it's always a circular argument with gold. You know, we talked about the US dollar weakness, but on the other side, yeah, there's a very strong inverse correlation to the US 10-year bond rate. And that has been increasing, and it's still obviously very low level, but now back over 1%. And that is a negative driver of the gold price. And yeah, that's part of why we've seen some softness in the price over the last little bit. I think when we think about the equities, though, it's really important to recognize that, yeah, the current band we're in, which is sort of $1,800 an ounce to $1,900 an ounce, is still an absolute fabulous price for the gold producers. I mean, yeah, they've got the benefit of being in a very strong price environment, and from their point of view, never having balance sheets stronger, and you know, the outlook is still very rosy with them.
And what do you think they're going to do with the money? So if there's not sort of growth projects to stick it in. Are they going to start buying each other, or are they going to give it back to shareholders? Are they?
Yeah. Well, that's the problem with mining companies, isn't it? You always want them to have some debt to keep them honest. Look, absolutely, we think M&A is going to be a theme of the year. I think, you know, gold companies obviously have a very checkered history when it comes to discipline. You know, I remember having some very strong debates with fund managers in the past that basically, you know, telling me off for having a gold company generating free cash flow in my model, and they said that just never happens.
That's right.
But you know, I think, you know, the parties here is that gold production isn't easy to replace, and mines do tend to deplete quite quickly. It always is a sort of a market of feast or famine, and M&A is actually part an important place in replacing and growing production, because exploration, you know, is tough and hasn't delivered, you know, a lot in recent times. So, you know, we think that one of the things we will see is gold companies will conduct M&A. One of the issues has obviously been COVID has meant that, you know, DD is hard to do, and as we start to see people being able to move around the world more, you know, I think that will be a catalyst for for DD for ongoing M&A as well.
Hmm. When you say hard to do, I guess just in that you think they want to get out and actually see the operations of the individual of the places they're going to buy, or is it was it just a relationship side?
Well, I mean, so if you're a BD person, you're basically putting an M&A transaction up to the board. The first question they're going to ask is, so what did you think when you went and saw the asset? And if they can't say we've been there and we've kicked the tires and, you know, this is where how we think we can add value to the transaction, I think it's almost impossible.
Yeah, because I guess where I'm leading with that question is, it seems as if emerging markets are going to be a fair way behind developed markets in terms of the rollout of vaccines. And but I guess, I suppose, if you're vaccinated, you can still travel around to those, I suppose. Yeah, it's just more open.
Yeah, I mean, the companies have been quite open in saying that a lot of the deals that have been done recently are ones where they either had part ownership or had had an opportunity to do DD in the past. But I think you're right, and that's part of why, I guess, you know, some of the transactions have been more kind of in-country. So, you know, the biggest transaction, one of the biggest transactions over the last 5 years was actually the merger of Northern Star and Saracen in the gold space. And that's one where, you know, it was shared assets and being in the same state that allowed that to happen.
Mm. Yes. Yeah, that's right. And so it's you've already done your due diligence because you already own the own it. David Wellen Smith, did you have any questions on gold? What's your...
Yeah,
lost him.
Might have I think himself. One of the I think one of the things that you were is worth touching on is the cost, because I think that is something that's kind of important for gold and, you know, what the current margins are, and does the higher price actually create inflation within the cost base? Because that's what we saw last time around. And I think this time around there's a few things that are a little bit different. I mean, for the sector, I think the all-in sustaining costs, so in other words, the cost to produce it plus the cost of the capital that allows you to sustain that, is in the order of $925 for the US dollars per ounce. So that's a very healthy margin where we sit today at $900, in the margin field at $900. But I think, you know, what we actually don't see in inflation over the next 12 months, or very little, because we had higher costs associated with COVID last year. We also saw the impact to operations last year, where I think this year's supply should be pretty much back to normal from each of the mines. Plus we have an ongoing kick from what were the low energy prices last year, because energy is around a third of the cost base of any gold mine. So that to us sort of points to the fact that costs, underlying costs, should be actually reasonably similar this year to last year, which is another positive for the sector.
Mm. And are they at any stage... I've got to take a bit of a step back on this. On the energy side, is we've got this view that solar plus batteries sort of presents this upper bound for energy prices, and it means that, you know, as if the price, so if you start getting price spikes above that people just start installing solar plus batteries, and that then caps their the cost they need to spend. And I guess, well, I'm just looking at the mining companies, though. I mean, and saying, let's say for a gold miner, like how much, when you say a third of its energy, how much of that's the actual mining side, and how much of it's the processing, I guess, and or how much of it would be easily electrifiable versus you're stuck with the oil, you know, as the oil price being the key input.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things in that. I mean, first of all, unfortunately, mines are not located next to cities, so, you know, generally mines are in quite remote locations, so, you know, you haven't got the advantage of grid power or something like that, so you need to import all your energy generally into the mine, which is why there's such a high reliance on it. And as you say, it depends. You obviously have requirements to run the equipment, the fleet. But generally, a big part of that energy requirement is energy to run run the plant. One of the key things there is obviously that, you know, companies are incentivized to keep costs as low as they can. And in many situations, the ability to have some solar plus battery is obviously advantageous. But the other really big driver here is, you know, miners don't have a great track record. You just have to look at what happened with Rio recently. So putting in solar renewables is a big, big part of miners trying to show their social license to operate, that where they can, they are looking to minimize emissions and whatever. And, you know, it can have a very large impact on their emissions by putting in renewables.
Yeah, and I'm guessing though as well, how many of these operations, say in the gold space, would be 24-hour operations versus sort of 8-hour operations?
They're all 24. They're all 24, 365 days a year.
So you need a fair bit of battery storage, fair bit more battery storage than say if you're a manufacturer in a, you know, trying to run your factories off that, working on it, working through
it. And ultimately, you're always going to have backups anyway. You know, you can never run 24/7 on just solar, obviously, but it's a way of reducing but not eliminating emissions and lowering the overall energy costs within the business.
Yeah. It is. And copper then, so moving, well, is there anything else on gold?
Oh, that's probably a very short explanation of the gold market. But the copper again is an interesting one. And I think there's a few interesting points given the discussion we had on lithium before. I think people might think that, you know, renewables is a big part of the copper market, and at the end of the day, it's not yet. And probably a long way from being, if at all. You know, the global copper market's around 24.5 million tons of consumption a year. So when we think about renewables, in terms of that market, you know, solar and wind, and they're probably a lot more established than EV, you know, and represent probably around a quarter of global energy electricity generation, they probably represent about 600,000 tons of that of copper consumption globally. So it's a very modest sort of 2.5% of annual demand. Obviously, EVs the new entry and the new potential source of demand. But again, current, you know, EV hybrid demand for copper is only in the order of about 200,000 tons a year. Now, it's grown quite high off a low base. I think it was, you know, up over 50,000 tonnes the last year, but that's still equivalent to a very small kind of copper mine. And I think if you put them both together, you know, renewables in terms of the copper space is only around 3% of total demand for copper. So at current growth rates, you know, in 5 years' time, it might add another sort of 500,000 to 1 million tonnes of demand for copper, which is still pretty modest.
And still pretty minor. And there's a flip side problem with copper as well, is that, you know, let's say that solar power does expand a lot, and it means that you stop having long distance connections, and everything's more about just centralized electricity generation. Local electricity generation versus, you know, across major parts, and then maybe there's actually a little bit of a demand destruction from reducing the amount of interconnection.
Maybe, but I think a fair while in the future.
But I guess what I'm trying to get to is, and that was, yeah, that was my point on this one, because I've seen it touted a few times as saying, hey, copper's going to, you know, the amount of copper they need in an EV is way more than in a normal car. And I buy that, but it's also the part about saying, well, if driverless cars hit, though, then they think, you know, they'll only need a third of the cars or a quarter of the cars that they need. And so you've got these, there's a few competing factors in there that don't make it a complete positive for copper. But the other part of copper as well is, you know, obviously leveraged to just industrial production. And we have seen a bit of a bounce back in terms of the goods side, you know, as we're learning to live with COVID as opposed to completely coming out of it. I guess, do you see, like, how elastic do you see the supply side of the copper market in terms of, you know, is it something where if we do see a big burst of demand that the copper price will shoot significantly higher on that, or is it more that we'll start seeing just more and more mines come on or people expand existing mines?
Okay, yeah, there's a few things in that. I mean, you know, copper is your ultimate global GDP plus kind of story, very high correlation over the years, and I think that will still hold. You know, China is obviously over half of the market, and their demand remains very robust and has been one of the key drivers of the price being where it is. But on top of that, you've obviously had other factors such as the US dollar weakness, and what has been quite a hit to supply last year, given that the majority of the world's copper is produced out of South America, and obviously that's one of the areas that was hit hardest by COVID, and there was a lot of mine supply that was impacted last year. And on top of that, you know, from the supply side point of view, we've just had a number of the companies updating on their guidance for 2021. And overall, a number of those producers have taken a little bit more of a conservative outlook for next year. So as we see the copper market at the moment with a pretty modest growth assumption, the outlook for copper is for the next 2 years, it's probably going to be in deficit. And when you're in deficit with very low inventory levels, it obviously supports a higher price. And that price is trying to incentivize the producers to obviously bring on new supply as quick as they can. And there's a couple of factors there, being that, you know, copper companies are one of the more leveraged sectors in the wider resource space. And those companies have to go through a deleveraging exercise. But also there's actually very, very little in the way of projects in the pipeline that can come through, and companies are certainly not aggressively pushing development of those projects. So it's one where, from a supply point of view, the picture is actually quite supportive of the price, albeit we've obviously had a very strong run in price very quickly, which will obviously always make you sort of a little bit more cautious.
Mm. And I guess, is that the development side as well? Is the development's muted because companies are looking and thinking, well, there's other guys out there some of the South American players who will just sort of naturally bring back the supply on as they get on top of COVID. Is that
part of it? There's, you know, copper companies it costs a lot to bring on a new project, because the new projects are generally very, very large and need a lot of infrastructure. And anything in South America, as an example, now you can't get water, so you have to build a desalination plant, you need a power plant, etc. So to build a new copper mine takes a lot of capital, and companies are still being conservative with how they invest. And, you know, copper companies, as I said, are still reasonably leveraged, and a number of them would probably feel more comfortable about deleveraging to a degree before they start massive new reinvestment.
Yeah, and at what level? So what are we, about $8,000 a ton at the moment? At what levels does it start to people start falling over themselves to get out and rush their projects?
Well, I mean,
do the price need to go to $10,000?
Well, this is the key thing. Like, today's price is a fantastic price and should be incentivizing people. The point is, there's not a lot of projects to bring forward, and those producers. And the delay, it takes a long time. I mean, part of the issue that this time around, compared to last time when everyone was aggressively reinvesting, there was a lot of projects ready to go, that then did get built and haven't been replaced. But also, it's increasingly hard these days to actually permit a new project. Yeah, there's some massive copper projects in the US that just have continued over recent years to be knocked back on the permitting side, and that has a big impact.
Right. Okay. I'm not sure if you've got anything. I know. Thanks for your time, David. I'm just not sure if you've got anything else you wanted to talk about. We've sort of got, maybe 10 minutes left. Just wanted to see if there's any other thoughts you had that we should cover off.
I guess when I look at the sector, there's obviously a couple of things to think about where we sit today. There was a lot of expectations of a recovery in 2021 after, we all couldn't wait to get rid of 2020. There is still, from a commodities point of view, still a lot of uncertainty, I think, out there in the economic drivers. As I said, we're starting 2021 on the back of, a last quarter rally, which was nearly as strong as that GFC bounce back. That means that we do see some valuations becoming quite stretched. The other side of it being, though, that, the balance sheets for the sector overall has never been as strong. We are seeing also as a positive, record prices for iron ore, copper and gold, which is in part reflecting that expectation of US dollar weakness. So it's a really fascinating time to be looking at the space.
Yeah, it's right. We've got some macro, there's a macro calls in one direction and that's what we're trying to, I guess the big reason for getting on is trying to tie up some of the macro and the micro side. And I guess in terms of Aussie miners versus the miners you look at internationally, so which are the developed markets?
We cover all. So we have a global coverage base, which I think in the mining space, given the nature of the sector, is really the only way to look at it. So we can compare all sectors globally and look in regards to that. If I take copper as an example, the Aussie copper companies are at the moment laying and trading at a discount to their North American and European peers, which I think is interesting. Albeit, we've only really got a handful of companies and they are relatively small scale to what you can get offshore. But then on the flip side to that, the Aussie gold companies are trading very, very well. And if anything, are at a little bit of a premium to what we see out of the North American gold companies at the moment. Part of that is obviously because the balance sheets are robust. They're very well run. So Aussie gold companies tend to be run by, ex-miners rather than the North American peers that tend to be ex-investment bankers, which is quite a contrast.
And given you've done some investment banking, you're not paying a compliment there.
It's a different outlook, shall we say. But I think that's part of why the Aussies have done so well recently, is because when times get tough, having actual people that have genuine experience at the coalface, so to speak, actually comes through. So the Aussies is probably a little bit more expensive, but it all comes down to, as well, sovereign risk. And, obviously, we've handled COVID well. We're a low-risk jurisdiction, and that plays into part of that premium for the gold companies.
Mm. And quality-wise, I guess in terms of the quality of the assets, do you see big differences then between, the copper market and the gold, copper and gold, just in terms of between what So you're talking about the quality of the management themselves, which is obviously have some effect on it. But in the end, if you're pulling out 2 grams a ton of gold versus pulling out 6 or 7 grams a ton of gold, obviously makes a huge difference. I guess any thoughts on you know, the copper and companies you can get in Australia or the gold companies you can get in Australia versus what you can see overseas?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. I mean, look, we wouldn't be a major producer of the majority of the world's commodities if we didn't have, I guess, good quality assets. Certainly our iron ore assets are amongst the best, but also one of the key advantages is we're closer to China. Yeah, we're 8 days shipping versus 30 days, which has a big impact.
Which is an issue for iron ore, but not for the other commodities, obviously, is they're so much more expensive per tonne anyway.
Yeah, it's a big bonus for the bulk commodities. Where gold, you can just, you know, load a week's production onto the back of a light plane and fly it out. But I think, you know, our copper assets are good, but I mean, they're never going to compete with some of the vast assets that you get out of South America. And obviously, you know, lithium is one of those new emerging things we've talked about where we do have a lot and we have some interesting assets there. The history is kind of interesting because, you know, you think about, you know, our biggest and best lithium asset, which is Greenbushes. You go back 10 years ago and they were almost throwing the lithium away because it was actually a spodumene mine, a tantalum mine. But we're getting a bit off track there. Sorry.
No, but I guess it's actually one of the ones I was getting to in a way as well, is because the lithium stuff is all, the Australian stuff is all from rocks, though, isn't it? As opposed to the a lot of the South American ones is the salt flats, which is obviously a different technology. And I believe the Aussie stuff's easier to get into the batteries.
Well. I mean, I think one of the more interesting things is the environmental side, because the hard rock mines here have a relatively small footprint, but obviously the brines out of Chile and Argentina, you know, one of the concerns the government has is the potential impact on those on the environment, which is a really interesting thing to think about going forward. And I think all the miners are thinking the same. So, you know, the mining community as a whole is trying to modify the way it does things to try and have a lower footprint going forward.
Okay, and I've got one more thought just from completely left field. I just wanted to get your thoughts on. There's obviously a few, you know, given Elon Musk is now, well, depending upon what day, he's either the richest man in the world or in the top five at least. He's obviously got some thoughts on space mining and you know, asteroids and things like that. Are we 10 years away, 20 years away, 50 years away?
I think we're a long, long way away. From that, I think we'll be doing the traditional way of doing it for a long time. It's just comes back to the cost of it. You know, we're not even near the prices that would justify or incentivize people to mine that way.
Yeah, it's good. Seems like a problem for my kids or my exactly. or their
maybe,
kids.
Rather maybe than, our grandkids will have to worry about that one.
Yeah. Yes. Excellent. Tim, did you want to?
All right. Very good. Yeah. No, look, thanks for that. We'll jump across to the investment outlook now. Damien, you can run through that and perhaps David might chime in with his thoughts.
Yeah. I just want to... So just to focus, obviously... overnight, markets have tumbled a fair bit in the US. We've certainly stretched. I think what we've been focused very much on is that we're not living in a normal market. We're living in something that's driven by central banks and governments. And so, you know, that's our sort of key focus at the moment is seeing where that support's coming from. In terms of the reporting season so far, we've been quite focused as well. So the US is reporting at the moment the fourth quarter, and what we'll start to see is the Aussie companies report so over the next month. Results to date, while there haven't been many, we look at about, of the ones we're looking, so about 150 odd companies have reported. The results have been really, really good. So you know, we've had this thought for a while that companies have really taken a knife to their costs, and they won't need the sales to bounce back as far in order to actually see the profits. And so far, that's certainly looking like being the case. So, you know, I guess watching this space, but eyes are very much on governments and stimulus and how much support is forthcoming, and then back to companies as well that have actually been reporting surprising good profits. Having said that, there's a very expensive market out there, but you could tier it very much. You can tier it into, I think we've got about the top 10% of companies. If you look at out sort of 2 years' earnings, you still have to pay about 45 to 50 times earnings. So they're very, very expensive relative to history. But if you look at the other end of the market, some of the cheaper stocks and some of the value stocks, they actually don't look a stretch in terms of in terms of the valuations. So we're expecting to see something probably similar to what you saw sort of post the tech boom. As you came off the tech boom, what you saw was that, you know, the NASDAQ fell sort of 30-40% in the first 6 months, and value stocks were actually up over that time period, and the S&P was largely flat. So I guess we are expecting to see that at some stage. Are we there yet? I don't know, but we think sometime in the next sort of year or so, you will see that action very much start to take hold. So for us, it's all about getting the value stocks and staying in the expensive growth.
Okay, very good. Anything to add to that one, David?
Oh, I mean, I would just add that, you know, from the perspective, as we've said, there's still a lot of uncertainty out there. We still think there's a very strong case for having gold as an insurance policy in your portfolio. And then the only other comment that I think is worth just mentioning is, you know, rates are very low at the moment. Everyone's looking for where they can get yield, and, you know, we just suggest people have a look at, the diversifieds at the moment, because, you know, given what we can see with the iron ore price today, I think, they're offering pretty attractive yields. We can see yields of at least sort of 7.5% for that sector, with potential upside given the windfall profits they're making at the moment.
Mm. Very good. Okay, wonderful. Well, look, thanks very much for your time today, David. It was great. Just as we often do, we finish up just by offering an opportunity for yourself to share with our audience where they might get in touch with you or follow some of your work.
Yeah, sure. Look, we've got a website. It's globalmining.com, globalminingresearch.com. Our contact details are all there. Happy for people to reach out.
Wonderful. All right. Well, look, thanks again for your time. And we look forward to getting you back on the show again. I'm sure this global mining boom's got plenty more left in it, and look forward to getting you on and sharing your thoughts once more. Thanks again for coming along, David. Cheers. And thanks to you, Damien, as well, for a great chat.
Thanks, Jim.
And no problems. We'll jump across to our viewer question of the week. Before we do, I'll just let people listening in know that we will be producing a remastered podcast, just for those that were having a little bit of trouble hearing David with the mic issues that were just coming up in the YouTube. So we'll put that link in the show notes so you can get the remastered one, where it will all be very, very clear. Viewer question of the week: is mining experiencing a short-term blip or a structural boom? Feel free to drop in your answers in the comments of this video, of course. Always look forward to reading those and working through those and potentially using those as impetus for another show as well. Coming up next week, as Damien alluded to there a little bit in his investment wrap-up, we put together a bull case for equity in 2021. With markets already at stretched valuations, the fundamental alarm bells are starting to ring that it could be the top of a normal market. But as Damien mentioned, is it a normal market? By all accounts, most say no. With the pandemic still in full swing in many major economies and the requisite waves of stimulus still to come, how much longer can this unique bull market be expected to continue? So tune in next week, Thursday the 4th of Feb, 12:30 p.m. as usual, to find out why you should hold stocks in 2021 and perhaps which ones. Thanks to all those that have watched in live for another great episode. I hope you've taken away some great ideas. And if you haven't already, feel free to click like on the video to give us some feedback. And if you'd like to see more of our content, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content to stay up to date on news from us. Follow us on social media. And finally, if you know anyone who gets something out of today's episode, let them know about it, share with a friend, and help our show grow. So thanks again for tuning in from myself, Tim Fuller, and the team. And we look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.